Good morning. Welcome to the roundtable. It is Monday again. Rude. I'm Sarah LaDuc in for Joe Donahue this morning, here to discuss a lot of, you know, of course, rather heavy, serious news stories. There don't tend to be light ones of late, and that is what we're in for and what we're here for. Joining me in studio this morning, corporate attorney with Phillips Lytle LLP, Rich Honan. Good morning, Rich.
Good morning.
Have I hosted with you in here before?
You have not.
I didn't think so.
I'm very excited.
Okay.
I'm excited about the whole thing.
Be good. political consultant and lobbyist Libby Post is here. Good morning, Libby.
Good morning.
Nice to see you. And we're also joined by Albany Law School professor of law and director of the Justice Center, Sarah Rogerson. Good morning, Sarah.
Good morning.
You can join the conversation by emailing us, panel@wamc.org, panel@wamc.org. Please keep your letters short, on topic. Proofread them real quick if you have a sec so we can make sure we understand what you're trying to get across. And we will look forward to hearing from you. I think we'll begin this morning with an ongoing story about protests, arrests, college campuses, free speech, and war. Protests are roiling college campuses nationwide. This is from the AP. As schools with graduation ceremonies next month face demands that they cut financial ties to Israel because of the Israel-Hamas war. Many campuses were largely quiet over the weekend, but protesters on both sides of the issue shouted and shoved each other during the dueling demonstrations Sunday at the University of California in Los Angeles. About 275 people were arrested on Saturday at various campuses, including Indiana University in Bloomington, Arizona State University, and Washington University in St. Louis. The number of arrests nationwide approached 900 since the New York police removed a pro-Palestinian protest encampment at Columbia University and arrested more than 100 demonstrators on April 18th. Since then, students have dug in at dozens of pro-Palestinian encampments around the country, prompting a range of responses from administrators, arrests and criminal charges, student suspensions, or simply continued pleas to leave. The plight of students has become a central part of protests, with both the students and a growing number of faculty demanding amnesty for protesters. At issue is whether the suspensions and legal records will follow students through their adult lives. Let us begin discussing. I'll start with you, Sarah.
Sure. I've represented protesters, and in Albany, there's a policy because we're in the nation's capital and protests happen all the time, including some protests with elements of civil disobedience, which in certain circumstances is totally appropriate and part of being American. So, there's a fair amount of pearl clutching that happens around these types of things. I've seen it up close and personal. I'm 100% on the side of amnesty for those who were not breaking laws outside of sort of a civil disobedience norm. And I also think of Charlottesville. Every time there are crackdowns on protests on campuses because, you know, in Charlottesville, Nazis marched through chanting anti-Semitic phrases and were not arrested. The police were specifically instructed to stand down and allow people with blazing torches screaming hate speech to wander around a campus, which increased over time to lead to ultimately the events of October 10th, October 11th in Charlottesville, where Heather Heyer lost her life due to violent, hateful activities that were allowed to spiral out of control. So it's interesting, the contrast between pretty speedy, immediate, and aggressive response by law enforcement to, like, peaceful law professors and largely peaceful students, contrasted against Charlottesville hate speech, burning torches. You know, it begs a lot of questions.
Rich.
I don't know what was speedy and immediate about any of the responses, but I certainly agree on Charlottesville, and I think those people should have been arrested. I think that goes way beyond First Amendment rights. You know, I think there was violence, there was intimidation, there was, and I'm sure a number of civil things as far as, you know, getting permits and all those things. And there's reasons for that. So the fact that Charlottesville was so mishandled should not be, should not form the template for this. And I think that, Sarah, question.
Yeah.
Aside from the campus protests, you call it civil disobedience? The people who are blocking the streets,
yes,
or blocking the bridges.
So that
falls into acceptable civil disobedience as well.
It does. If in organizing communities, there are ways to do that safely and communicate to the public what's happening. And in a lot of cases, that happens. It doesn't make the news, and unless you're there, you don't see it. But I've attended many of these as a legal observer. And often there are a lot of controls. I wouldn't say controls. Organizational and tactical strategies to keep the protesters safe and observers safe.
Well, that, none of that
including
happened,
diversion of traffic.
None of that happened in any of. I didn't see any of that reported in any of the events that happened at the Golden Gate Bridge or the Brooklyn Bridge. Was it Brooklyn Bridge? JFK or SeaTac Airport. I just saw lots and lots of people either inconvenienced or more.
Which is the point, right? Like, so
is the point?
Some cases, yeah.
A disruption of
the norm.
Habit and norm to draw attention to an issue.
Yeah, I certainly agree with that. And look, when I think of civil disobedience, you know, I think of, the people at the lunch counters, right? To me, that's kind of the highest and best form of making your point and making your point against the offending people, okay? And I think that's one of the big disconnects on this is that people seem to be making their point to somebody who's trying to drive to work, you know? And I wonder if they're really trying to make a point or if they're just trying to be disruptive. But having said that, I think the Charlottesville was a bad template. It distresses me that we continue to follow that template. I think there's got to be rules, and the First Amendment is probably our most powerful amendment, but it's not an exemption from responsibility for your actions or your words.
Well, there's a difference. There's a huge difference between having a sit-in to ask the university that you pay tuition to divest from Israeli investments.
Sure.
Or investments in the Israeli government, which is also like a lot of subtlety is missed in all of this. And I'm not sure every student participating appreciates all of that subtlety. Right?
That's the problem.
Well, it's going to be the problem in any human endeavor, right? So there are some students who are participating, the vast majority of them, who should be able to exercise their rights in this country. What to do, how to identify, and what to do with the students who are engaging in violence with one another is a separate question. It doesn't doom the entire exercise. Unlike, we can talk about January 6th, too. Throw that in the mix.
Libby?
Well, I think part of the problem here is that these protesters don't get the nuance of what's going on.
You don't think any of them do?
I don't, look, when I hear things like from the river to the sea, by any means necessary, globalize the intifada, say it loud and say it clear, we don't want no Zionists here, which grammatically means they do, but that's besides the point. Okay. There's only one solution, Intifada revolution. We are Hamas. Hamas makes us proud. Israel's the new Nazi Germany. I mean, I believe in the freedom of speech. I do not necessarily believe in the freedom for hate speech. And that's what this is, because we cannot deny that what's gone on in the last few months since October 7th, lionizing Hamas as freedom fighters and not recognizing them as a terrorist organization, has just increased the amount of anti-Semitism in this country and across the world, for that matter, to levels we haven't seen since the 1940s. You know, Charlottesville is sort of child's play compared to what's going on now. I mean, Charlottesville set the stage in a sense, but these Charlottesville people are so far to the right.
Well, it's different.
These
it's got to be different people.
Right.
Well,
right.
They were
totally different
They were
people.
Also weaponized. they were carrying live
I get that they were
ammunition.
Carrying it. Yeah, so yeah. What? I mean, you know what? Okay, fine. They were doing their thing. These folks are doing their thing. And the fact of the matter is, those of us who were Jewish and are proud of the fact that we're Jewish are stuck in the middle, especially people like me who are have progressive politics, don't want a library to say no to a speaker just because we don't agree with what they say. But then when that speaker or these folks who are protesting cross this line and tacitly are saying things that say it's okay to target Jews, and that's what this is really about.
What about the Jewish students who have joined these protests is what I'm because I really want to, I just want to make sure we're not categorizing an entire group of people. There is a lot of nuance here. There is a lot of individual conduct. I'm not taking away from the negativity at all, but you know, I want to be clear that there are a lot of Jewish
Look,
students
my brother's
that are
there. Okay? My brother is there. You know, he's doing his thing. We don't agree on this issue. We don't agree on a lot. He's there.
Is your brother lionizing Hamas or calling for a ceasefire? And I know you're maybe you don't want to say what your brother is doing.
I don't talk to him.
Okay. I have those as well.
Okay. Yes. We talk twice a year to keep my mother of blessed memory happy.
Sure.
On our
totally
birthdays.
Understand.
Right. You know, but he signed the CUNY letter. So that sets the stage, right? The CUNY letter that, you know, supported Hamas and supports and does not support Israel, supports BDS and all that sort of stuff. So, you know, for somebody like me who's in the middle here, because I am a Jew, I'm a proud Jew, I don't consider myself a Zionist in any way. I've never been to Israel. It's not like this is what drives me. What drives me is the fact that my father fought against the Nazis in World War II. What drives me is I was called a Christ killer on the bus as a kid. Mm-hmm. Okay? What drives me is that these folks who are saying these things do not understand the import of their words and how it leads to more anti-Semitism and more targeting of Jews in this country and around the world. And that is my concern. This is the rise of anti-Semitism and how that all plays into everything else, like giving credence to the people in Charlottesville. Because these folks are on the left and they're saying, we don't deserve to live. And then the folks on the right are saying, we don't deserve to live. So it's really it's sort of a conundrum. You know, thank God, in a sense, I live in the United States right now. We'll see what happens in November, right? You know, November, if Trump is elected in November, and somebody said to me yesterday, they think Netanyahu is doing what he's doing to make sure that Trump gets elected in November, to keep things going, to keep this, to keep the whole conflict going so that it weakens Biden within the Democratic Party and it'll keep kids home from voting. It's an interesting dynamic. It's an interesting way of looking at things. I don't know how true it is. I think Netanyahu is doing this to keep himself out of jail and in power. But we're dealing with ideologues, we're dealing with demagogues, we're dealing with totalitarians who want to run the world. Look at what's going on in Russia. We see what's happening in Israel in terms of Netanyahu not paying attention to what the people want, you know. So my real concern here, as I keep going back to, is the rise in anti-Semitism, the targeting of Jews, and what's going to be the next step. You know, swastikas on campus. I was with somebody yesterday who told me that their husband teaches in one of the local schools. He's a music teacher, and he handed somebody a music stand, and four or five swastikas were etched into the music stand. You know, it's that sort of thing. When you go to a college campus and your whiteboard is defaced, you know, because you're Jewish, you know? I mean, there are things that if you're not Jewish, you don't necessarily understand the impact that these kinds of acts have. It's not something where you can just pat us on the head and say, don't worry, dear, everything's going to be okay, because that's what they said in Germany in the 30s.
Yeah, I certainly don't mean to say any of that. But there is a difference between the message that is the formal message of the encampments and then what's happening on the edges of that conversation?
I'm not sure that there's so much of a distinction here. I'm really not. And you know, if we substituted other ethnic groups for the word Jew and some of what people are saying, people would be absolutely outraged.
Again,
but because it's Jews, they're not.
Yeah, if Muslim students felt that they were being targeted on campus, these would have been shut down after a day, which they should have been. And I could name other ethnic groups that if the targeting was against them, I think the response would have been very different.
Welcome back to the Roundtable panel. I'm Sarah Leduc in for Joe Donahue this morning in studio with Rich Honan, Libby Post, and Sarah Rogerson. We are discussing campus protests of the Israel-Hamas war, and we have a lot of email. We will begin with some email from listeners to launch us back into conversation. Let's see. And I thought I was ready. Okay. Rick writes in and says, do you think there's a possibility that some foreign influences are stirring up more protesting in order to foment increasing unrest in the country? You mentioned that. Libby's nodding.
I have no doubt. I have no doubt.
Well, I know what I'm told, what I read. Let's put it that way. Okay. That these days you can't, you have to disclaim everything. I forgot the name of the group. One of them is the U.S. Committee for Palestinian Rights.
Yeah.
And, you know, fairly heavily funded by a George Soros entity. So I don't know about foreign entities, but I know that there were at least three organizations that were heavily involved in the planning of these protests, and they are. You know, Soros backed and backed by, you know, other, you know, kind of far, you know, left wing groups. I haven't seen anything. I haven't seen any demonstration that there's foreign money going in. I know that there have been wonderings, but I haven't seen any evidence of that. I don't know if anybody else has.
Doesn't seem like it. Joel writes in and says, if the thousands of students who are demonstrating against U.S. involvement in Israel's war in Gaza do not vote for Biden as they say they will not, Trump will be president.
Right.
Do they know what that means? That means it will be far, far worse.
That's what people don't get.
I wanted to ask you about that because I knew you'd be on. They're not going to vote for Trump.
They're not going to vote.
They're just not going to vote?
They're going to stay home. Yeah, they're going to stay home, which then they'll get Trump and you know, it's the doorway to fascism in this country.
Some participants, like, again, I want to, they is not the hundreds of protesters, right?
No,
but
students are going to stay home.
Some students have said that they will stay home. Some students.
Well, we'll see on November 5th.
All across the political spectrum, some students have said that they're going to sit this out.
I doubt the ones who want Trump are going to stay home. I think the ones who see Biden as being a collaborator with Netanyahu and Israel will stay home. And what we'll get is Donald Trump. And that is worse than anything I can imagine because he will weaponize government against all of us.
But, I mean, there's months and months between now and the election. I can't believe that the Biden campaign and other groups are not going to get the word out that, hey, Trump was the guy who moved our embassy to Jerusalem. Trump is, you know, heavily pro-Israel. They'll get that news out, and I feel like that's going to appeal to the people who are upset with Biden.
I'm sure there'll be plenty of messaging as we get closer, and you know, it is sort of still a little early. I mean, we're before the June primary. You know,
but we're 45 years into this election cycle.
Yeah, right. We are 45 years. Right.
Well, the daily.
I'd rather be 46 years, to be quite honest with you. But, you know, and things will ramp up. We won't see much of it here in New York because New York is going to go blue and that's the end of that. We can, you know, pretty much guarantee that. But you'll see it in other places. And you might see what you'll see is targeted social media outreach and web-based outreach to these demographics to hopefully get them to vote, for them to recognize that Biden is a better ally in their fight for what they want, for the changes they want in Gaza and in Israel, than Trump will ever be.
Well, and that's the Biden campaign's job, yeah, is to draw that line, right?
And that's what they'll do.
Today's daily podcast from the New York Times has features. Here's what a second Donald Trump presidency would bring. So, for people who are wondering about what that might actually look like, and I, you know, we did the live at the Linda a couple weeks ago now.
Mm-hmm. Week ago, last Friday.
And you know, the points that were raised around climate change and other things are very well taken in terms of, like, you know, what his position has really been on those. It's interesting in the reproductive rights area how differently Donald Trump threads that needle, right? Yeah. So, I mean, it's not going to be the same as his first presidency if he's reelected, but I do think it's important to note and to continue to note the differences between the leadership styles going forward.
David writes in to panel at WAMC.org and says, it is difficult for some to handle, but is it possible to support the existence of Israel, support a Palestinian state, and to condemn Netanyahu's right-wing government and Hamas terrorists? Well,
yes.
That's the whole question,
absolutely.
Isn't it?
Yes, absolutely. Absolutely. That's the nuance.
And we do.
That's part of the nuance, I think, that Sarah's talking about, that there's several things going on here. And I think all of us would say, well, at least I would say, I support all of those things.
Panel at WAMC.org. Brenda writes in and says, as a previous big supporter of Israel, it is with despair that I watch Netanyahu turn people against Jews. He is doing the job promoting anti-Semitism all by himself.
I get what she's saying, and on a certain level, that's true because of his policies and what he is doing, and he should have stopped what they are doing a long time ago. It's enough already. You know, they made the point, you're never going to totally root out Hamas and Hezbollah as long as they use their own people as shields, you know, because that's what they do. And the leadership is somewhere on the coast of Qatar, you know, having a nice life. So you can do both. And Netanyahu is not helping the situation. And I think many of us in the Jewish community feel that way. Many of us want to see him gone. Many of us know if an election was called, like Chuck Schumer has called for, he would be gone. He would no longer be prime minister. Let me put you that way.
Susan writes in and says, I totally get protesting. I couldn't wait until I got to college and could protest the Vietnam War, which directly affected my generation. What I find puzzling is why aren't college students protesting for colleges to divest from fossil fuels? Climate change is something that will cripple us all and needs to be addressed immediately.
I think they are. Yeah.
Panel at WAMC.org to join the conversation. Rich, you mentioned during the break you wanted to talk more about the evolution of civil disobedience,
just
et cetera.
The whole style of civil disobedience, you know, when I think of it, I think of, the lunch counters, you know, I think of, you know, Gandhi, you know, the things that, in my generation we were taught, you know, Martin Luther King and but there was some hallmarks of that that I think are missing, and one of them, I said it on air, and I think I said it during the break as we were commonly discussing the issues, first of all, I usually civil disobedience to me is most, I think of it as being kind of directed against the offending entity, as well as, you know, bringing the world's attention to an issue that you know, they might not otherwise know about. So that's the first thing. And the second thing is the hallmark of civil disobedience was the willingness to take responsibility for the actions. The people knew they were going to get arrested. In fact, unfortunately, a lot of them knew that they were going to probably, you know, get beaten up or worse, you know, in prison. And there's nothing right about that. But they, at least the getting arrested, you know, they knew that was going to happen. They knew that was going to be on their record. I think probably the people were, you know, wore that, you know, as a badge of honor, saying I stood up for my beliefs.
People still do, for the record. People in these movements, people are designated as either risking arrest or not.
And no, depending, they're not.
Yes, they are. But they're designated in advance. And then,
yeah, but they get. But then.
But they're already
outrage.
Getting amnesty. Barnard has already given amnesty to like 70% of the kids.
And people get outraged if they get arrested. Look, I was involved. I didn't get arrested because that's not my thing. But I was involved in organizing the civil disobedience at the Supreme Court on October 11th, right after the October 11th March on Washington in 1987. And everyone, and I did all the, I did a lot of the marketing and stuff like that. But everybody who was there knew that they were going to get arrested, and nobody said no. You know, nobody said that's horrible, or, you know, they knew what was going to happen because it was civil disobedience.
But it depends on
everybody knew.
But it depends on the charge. And in Washington, D.C., it's very different than whatever cops are charging in Columbia's campus. I don't know the details of the charges, but something like and a lot of the charges are sometimes ACOD'd or adjourned in contemplation of dismissal. Right. So there's like a conversation that happens with the prosecutor. There are different, every single protest has a very different way of being handled, even if it happens in the same place, around the same issue, around the same time. It just does. So it's important to, again, be a little more nuanced with how we're talking about this, because there's a big difference between being charged with assault of a police officer, for example, if you're defending yourself, versus, you know, a standard charge for trespass or something much lower, right? What are the students who are upset being charged with? That's an important question.
And I want, when this is all done, I want to see what percentage actually end up doing any jail time.
Yeah, I
think it's going to be a remarkably low percentage, at least in New York.
Do you want them to? Because like the January 6th protesters, we've been trying those cases for how many years now? And how many of them have seen any jail time for attempting to violently overthrow the government?
Yeah, I would do the same in both cases. To me,
they are not the same, to be clear. Not the same.
Why? Because one is in service of...
Because one were armed people storming the Capitol and breaking into the Senate and versus students in a sit-in on a college campus. Very different.
And calling for...
Unarmed.
Unarmed, but there's lots of there's physical intimidation going on. There's physical violence going on. And by the way, you keep saying students, and I'd like to also see the percentage of people that are being paid by the organizations we spoke about. The stipend is between $2,800 and $7,800, I think, a semester to be a organizer. Boy, you can't really do air quotes on the radio.
No. I think maybe your tone captured it.
Yeah, I'd like to think so.
felt pretty well achieved.
So I question the organicness. That's not a word. That's okay. I mean, that's okay, right? People can, protest no matter what the impetus is.
Teresa writes into panel at WAMC.org and says, Libby clearly has strong feelings on the issue for good reason, but while several panelists have talked a lot about what student protesters are doing wrong, what do you think they should do? I think it's accurate to say that the vast majority of students aren't anti-Semitic and don't support Hamas in any way, but are dismayed by the devastation they're seeing and that this country is enabling. Young people are frequently criticized for being self-centered, not voting, checked out. Now they are calling for a ceasefire. What do you think they should be doing?
First of all, I think she's wrong. I think most students do not support. I think what she said was wrong. She said that most students, do support Israel. What was the first thing she said?
She said that they're not anti-Semitic, and they don't support Hamas.
No, I think they absolutely are, and I think 60% of the people polled under the age of 24 felt that that Israel was the wrongdoer.
That's not anti-Semitic to say that the Israeli government is violating international human rights norms. That's not anti-Semitic.
Yeah,
it's not.
Look, I very much understand the criticism. I've said this before on the air. You can criticize Israel without necessarily being anti-Israel, and you can criticize Israel without being anti-Semitic. I think most of the people who criticize Israel are Jewish. Or maybe to put another way, I think Jews spend more time criticizing Israel than perhaps non-Jews. But I think when you're questioning the right of Israel to exist, and when you're questioning the underpinnings of a Jewish state, then I think it is anti-Semitic.
Absolutely. What a lot of the students are defending is the ability of the Palestinian people to form a state. And
well, then they should talk to Hamas, Sarah. To be quite honest with you, Hamas took over in 2014. There hasn't been a democratic election since. They don't want a democratic election because they may very well be voted out of office. Right? Hamas's charter is clear. They want to see the destruction of Jews and the Israeli state. So it's like it's a little difficult to like thread that particular needle or see all this nuance when the chants are so obviously geared to making sure Israel doesn't exist anymore. I'm not saying Israel is perfect because you know what? I don't think it is. All right? I think what Netanyahu has done in terms of making his bed with the ultra-Orthodox in the country. It's one of the reasons why October 7th happened was because Netanyahu was asleep at the wheel and they were more concerned with taking over the Supreme Court in the country and getting rid of protections for LGBT people, getting rid of protections for women, all of that sort of stuff, just like what they want to do here, just like what the right wing wants to do here. But when you say globalize the infiltrado, when you say kill another soldier now, when you say from the river to the sea, when you say Israel's the new Nazi Germany, okay, I'm sorry, but that does bleed over into anti-Semitism and makes the life of Jews in this country, whether we like the Hasids or not, okay, whether we, what Rich doesn't wear a kippah every day, neither do I, but for the kids who do and have it ripped off their heads, right? I remember when France was going through this and women's Stars of David were ripped off their necks, okay? You know, when that happens, then yeah, it bleeds into anti-Semitic action because it's not about Israel anymore, it's about Jews. And it really does take a fine mind to know the difference between anti-Semitism and anti-Zionism. And it bleeds right over, except for those who really can understand the distinction. And there's not that many people who do.
And it's very fair and important to critique that.
It's fair and important to
do what you're doing. And in terms of critiquing some of the tactics of the protesters, that's important. They are students. They need to learn. Not all of them appreciate the impact of that language in particular, and I'm not endorsing that language. It doesn't delegitimize the larger concept that we're talking about in terms of the right to protest. That's all. I just want to make sure that we're not undoing something.
No one's saying they don't have a right to protest. Look, I've been in plenty of protests. You know, I started in 1968 when I was 10 against the Vietnam War. I know it. I get it. Nobody's saying that they don't have a right to protest.
Well,
I'm saying is that they do not have the right to foment hate.
Agreed.
You were 10?
I think we all agree.
Yes, in 1968, I went to my first anti-war demonstration.
I'm trying to remember.
How old were you, Rich?
I don't know if he was born yet.
No.
I wasn't.
Well, the war, what was it, 74?
74. 74. It ended in 76.
I remember seeing the protests. I remember kind of, you know, walking with people like I was a kid. But the first protest I actually remember being in was when I was at University of Albany, and Hugh Carey was going to raise the tuition
yeah.
from $650 to $750. Yeah. I think it was a year, okay?
And it was organized. And gas was 10 cents a gallon.
Yeah, right. It was. And we walked down, I think everybody got, you know, everyone was going to leave class at 10 o'clock, and we walked down from you know, the SUNY campus all the way to the Capitol. And our chant was, screw Hugh, because Hugh's screwing you.
And what year was that?
That's so nuanced.
What year was that? Do you remember?
It was like my first year, 78, 79.
Okay, well, I was here. I came here in 78 to work for the group 79. That organized that protest, which was SASU,
the Student Association,
State University. I was part of that.
I went to a lot of SASU protests.
Yeah, I did too. I mean, I worked there. And, you know, protest has its role. There's no two ways about it. And I think it's an important civil right. We have the right to do that. We see if it wasn't for protests, you know, AIDS would still be killing many, many more people than it is right now. If it wasn't for protest, I wouldn't have had the ability to marry two good friends the other night, right, on Friday night. If it wasn't for protest, you know, we wouldn't be sitting here, to be quite honest with you.
Oh, yeah, and we wouldn't
right?
have the
Let's vote. Be honest, right? Yeah. And women would be barefoot and pregnant in the homes and going, you know, that's what Mike Johnson would like us to be and no longer have control over our bodies. So nobody's saying don't protest. What I'm saying is be careful about what you say and understand the impact that it has when you are using hate speech. And I do not think hate speech is protected speech, just like yelling fire in a theater is not freedom of speech. That's not protected.
Well, there's a reason why the First Amendment is a whole semester course in some law schools, because it's incredibly complex and very, very, very complicated. So I'm glad that we reset the table for the conversation and appreciate the listener comments too.
Panel at WAMC.org to join the conversation. This is the Roundtable Panel. I'm Sarah LaDuke here with Rich Honan, Libby Post, and Sarah Rogerson, and we will return after this quick break. Welcome back to the Roundtable Panel. I'm Sarah LaDuke in studio with Rich Honan, Libby Post, and Sarah Rogerson. White House National Security Spokesman John Kirby said President Joe Biden knows there are very strong feelings regarding the protests, but the president will leave managing the protests to local authorities. Do we think that is correct? Leave the managing the protests to local authorities, or should Biden be doing something?
Well, look, you know, let's see. Next week is May 4th. May 4th, well, some say it's the Star Wars.
May the 4th be with
May
you.
May the 4th be with you. I remember May 4th. It's the day that Kent State happened. Mm. And four kids were killed, one of whom was from my hometown. I knew his mom. His mom, who passed away recently, a couple of years ago, was a secretary in the high school. And the National Guard was called in. And that's who did the shooting.
Right.
So I think Joe Biden is being judicious and cautious. Because calling in the National Guard means bringing in the gendarmes and bringing in an army to counter protesters, and it's not a good thing because people could get killed.
It ups the level of tension. Yeah. Yeah. And also, I mean, I think it's important to note that the National Guard is largely comprised of people from the area, is my understanding. Mm-hmm. But still, it brings a federal element to it.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Yeah, it's not his place to. Now, I do think I would like it if he. Well, I know he's made some statements. I think he's been very cowardly about the statements that he's made because he's really trying to walk a political tightrope. But I do agree that it's a local issue, should be handled. I did hear that, was it Columbia or maybe it was GW, where the school asked the police, the city police, to disperse the protesters.
Columbia.
Was it Columbia? And the police said no because it would be bad optics because they. I'll have to get more on that. But it was one of those schools where the school that actually reached out and said, "Hey, you know, this is getting a little out of control. We need." And the police said no. It'll be bad optics. And again, I read that somewhere. So you have to disclaim everything these days. And I'll try and find out more about that.
Panel at WAMC.org to, I'm going to see if we have a newscaster in the other room. We don't yet. Panel at WAMC.org to join the conversation. We are going to begin a new topic shortly. But it feels a little bit funny to start it with 1 second to go. I'll set it up anyway. Putin, we'll move to one of the other wars. I don't mean to be so quippy. It's just it is my personality. I apologize because I know it is not funny. Putin's war will soon reach Russians' tax bills. This from the New York Times. President Vladimir Putin of Russia appears on track to institute a rare tax increase on corporations and high earners, a move that reflects both the burgeoning costs of his war in Ukraine and the firm control he has over the Russian elite as he embarks on a fifth term in office. Financial technocrats in Mr. Putin's government are searching for new ways to fund not just the war, but also a broader confrontation with the West that is likely to remain costly for years. Russia is allocating nearly a third of its overall 2024 budget, That's a third of its overall budget to a national defense spending this year, a huge increase adding to a deficit that the Kremlin has taken pains to keep in check. The proposed tax increase underscores Mr. Putin's rising confidence about his political control over the Russian elite and his country's economic resilience at home, showing that he is willing to risk alienating parts of society to fund the war. It would represent the first major tax overhaul in over a decade. Military spending and high oil prices have buoyed the Russian economy and driven up wages, despite causing higher inflation and shortages in the labor market. That is probably leading financial officials to see the current moment as a good time to push through tax increases.
You said 33% of their budget is going to the military?
A third of their so by contrast, overall budget.
NATO is having trouble doing 2%, right? Okay.
Yes. We are going now to take a news break. We'll have WAMC Regional News with Ian Pickus, and we will return to discuss this after that. Good morning. Welcome back to the Roundtable panel. I'm Sarah LaDuke in for Joe Donahue. It is Monday, April 29th, 10:07 a.m. I'm in studio with corporate attorney with Phillips Lytle LLP, Rich Honan, political consultant and lobbyist Libby Post, and Albany Law School professor of law and director of the Justice Center. Don't add T to justice. Justice Center Sarah Rogerson. We are about to launch into a discussion about military spending, President Vladimir Putin of Russia raising taxes on the wealthy and corporations to pay for the war in Ukraine. I set it up before the break. Who would like to begin?
Well, first, Rich. You know, I made the comment about the 2%, and I should make it clear that the 2% for NATO countries is 2% of GDP. And Sarah made the point off air that the United States spends, what, between
11% and 28% on defense at any given time over the last four decades.
You know, Putin is going to, I think, destroy his economy, but he doesn't really care. You know, he doesn't care. He wants to recreate Mother Russia. That's what this is all about. And Ukraine is the first step in that. And he will do what he will continue this. They will continue fighting back. The United States will continue to help Ukraine, which I think we should do. You know, and ultimately Ukraine will probably end up an independent nation in NATO. And that's going to make Putin even more insane.
Yeah, but they're never going to get him out of the areas.
No,
he's
not going to get out of Crimea, which he invaded.
No, I know that. But I'm saying the land, the areas that he took in this current war. I think it's going to be really hard to dislodge.
They have been able to dislodge them from some of the places. So
at great cost.
Yeah.
Oh yeah.
Human cost.
War is costly. And the way, you know, the story about the way they treated
the POWs.
The POWs is absolutely horrific. The sexual abuse, the sexual threats, the beatings, all of that. You know, but this is Vladimir Putin. We have to remember, this man came out of the KGB. He's not a good guy. He's a fascist. He's a totalitarian. And he just wants to recreate Russia as it was. During the Tsar's time. He wants to be the new Tsar. And that's really it.
I think as long as there's an appetite in the world for oil, he's going to be able to keep his economy.
Absolutely.
Even though, okay, you could say, yes, there's sanctions and it's $60 a barrel and everybody else is getting 83, but China's buying all, China and India are buying all the oil he can. You know,
drill.
Produce. Yeah, right. Yeah. So, I mean, and natural gas as well. So it's kind of an annuity, right? That's going to go on for at least for his lifetime. Yeah. Let's put it that way.
Few details are known about the planned increase. In a speech last Wednesday, Mr. Putin said his government was assessing various proposals. He said the new tax arrangements would remain fixed for a long period to ensure stability. And then a sentence that it's so many words that say almost nothing. Modernization of the fiscal system should ensure a more equitable distribution of the tax burden while stimulating businesses that develop and invest, including in infrastructure, social training, and projects. So we need more money to pay for everything, but this money is going to pay for the war.
Does anybody know what the tax rate in Russia is? I'm sorry, I shouldn't have asked that one, Cole.
Most Russians pay income tax at a flat rate of 13%.
Yeah. There you go.
The New York Times knew.
Wow.
Significantly lower than what taxpayers in the United States and Western Europe typically pay. So a flat rate of 13%. In an interview in March, Mr. Putin said he planned to introduce a new progressive tax scale, in part to alleviate poverty. A popular message among many Russians who support increasing taxes on the country's rich, which have been historically low. A tax that largely spares lower-income earners could also help mute discontent over the war among poorer Russians, who are providing much of the manpower for the army and bearing the brunt of casualties. Putin has signaled that the tax overhaul will include special incentives for certain groups, which could include Russians directly involved in the war effort or families with three or more children. I must have read it. I don't remember saying it out loud today, but I know that I read in this article. He feels, I mean, it's a huge indicator that he feels incredibly secure in his leadership.
Oh, God, yeah.
If he's going to raise taxes and
he
not.
He just got reelected, yeah. Right? So.
On the oligarchs?
Yeah. Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
His people.
Right.
There's a lot of language around lifting up the poor, blah, blah, blah. And I haven't watched it in the longest time, but I watched The Daily Show, which is now, again, Jon Stewart
on
has
Mondays.
Come back on Mondays. And, you know, now that we live in streaming land, you can watch whatever you want, whenever you want. So I checked it out. And there was, I mean, to your point about how sometimes you have to have some levity when you're talking about these topics, I was reminded how much mm-hmm. that helps. And there was a skit about last week's bipartisan defense spending bill in the United States. And it was like, oh, well, do I have better health care? No. Do we still have unhoused people in the streets? Yes. Okay, well, what about student loan forgiveness? Any of that? No. And it's like, but we've got new bombs and drones for you. And it just sort of, I mean, I know that it's satire, but sometimes it really crystallizes the trade-offs that we're making, the choices that we're making, and the values that are always espoused in budgets, whether we like it or not. Budgets are values-based documents. And what we value right now is restoring a global order, which, by the way, social safety net programs do a better job at, but here we are.
Libby alluded to this other story about the war in Ukraine. The Ukrainian Marine infantryman endured 9 months of physical and psychological torture as a Russian prisoner of war, but was allotted only 3 months of rest and rehabilitation before being ordered back to his unit. The infantryman, who has to be identified only by his call sign, Smiley, returned to duty willingly, but it was only when he underwent intensive combat training in the weeks after that the depth and range of his injuries, both psychological and physical, began to surface. I started having flashbacks and nightmares, he said. I would only sleep for 2 hours and would wake up with my sleeping bag soaking wet. He was diagnosed with post-traumatic stress disorder and referred for psychological care and is still receiving treatment. Ukraine is just beginning to understand the lasting effects of the traumas on its prisoners of war. Lasting effects of the traumas its prisoners of war experienced in Russia captivity, but it has been failing to treat them properly and returning them to duty too early, says former prisoners, officials, and psychologists familiar with individual cases. Nearly 3,000 Ukrainian prisoners of war have been released from Russia in prisoner exchange since the 2022 invasion began. More than 10,000 more remain in Russian custody, some of whom have endured 2 years of conditions that a United Nations expert described as horrific. This is from the New York Times. The Ukrainian government's rehabilitation program, which has usually involved 2 months in a sanitarium and a month at home, is inadequate, critics say, and the traumas suffered by Ukrainian prisoners are growing with the length and severity of the abuse that they are being subjected to as the war drags on.
Well, I mean, they're just running out of people.
Yeah.
Right? I don't mean to say just. I mean, the bottom line is that, you know, Putin is willing to commit more lives than Ukraine has at the moment.
Yeah.
You know, Ukraine isn't in a position right now to give these guys the time that they need to heal because of what they're up against. Nor do they have the depth within the military to really understand the impact of a war like this, because they've never had to deal with anything really like this before. You know, when Putin invaded Crimea, the guy who was in there before, you know, said, sure, come on in, right? Didn't say, no, we're going to fight you. So, you know, it's a catch-22 for Ukraine. It really, really is. They need their people to go out and continue fighting. But when they do and they're in this kind of situation, it really is a difficult position to be in.
Yeah, the human toll cannot be overstated.
Right.
Reading through what prisoners of war experience, and these prisoners of war in particular, given the degree of cruelty that they're up against with Russia. Yeah, I've represented hundreds of asylum seekers who flee to the United States because of some of various all manners of persecution. We really can get creative as a human race when we really want to inflict pain on each other. And Ukraine will never be the same. It was that way when the war began, and their cultural, you know, their big cultural centers were being torn apart, and now it's the hearts of their people, because when a prisoner of war comes home, it's not just that person who suffers; it's everyone who cares about that person too. So, different degrees, obviously, but they're going to need to invest in long term mental health solutions for their entire people for a very, very long time.
And that money's going to have to come from us and from others. I'm not saying it has to, but if given that Ukraine doesn't have the resources right now, so that's more, you know, that's the conundrum, Sarah. You know, you brought it up before. Yeah, there's tons of things we should be spending money on here at home, but what I heard, you know, weeks ago, you know, when people said if we don't give Ukraine this money, we don't give them this aid, they're going to lose, and there's a significant school of thought in the U.S. that says that would ultimately not be great for the U.S. So it's one of the reasons why, you know, we're trying to put more pressure on the NATO alliance, and there's going to be more. I think what you're going to really see is more pressure to transfer actual jets and planes to Ukraine, which so far has been, you know, we've been stopping short of that. And I think there's going to be significant pressure with all these factors to do that. And then the war gets even bigger.
Well, and in an active war zone, the percentage of funding that's going to go to supporting the soldiers' mental health is slim to none.
Right.
I mean, how much of that do we invest in our veterans in the United States? It's
right.
Disgusting. Yeah. It's appalling, actually. And the funding is actually going to the war economy, which doesn't care about the mental health of the participants in the war. It doesn't. It cares about making money. Lockheed Martin, the weapons manufacturers.
The military industrial complex got a big boost.
That's right.
With the arms bill, although I agree with sending money to Ukraine.
Yeah, I mean, what are you going to, I mean, unless you just want to say, look, you know, too bad, you know, Russia's going to take you over and, you know, try again. That's hard for us to say. I think from our own strategic standpoint, I don't think a more powerful Putin is a great thing for the United
for
States.
Oh, for sure. No,
the world.
No, Putin has put the entire world in this position, for sure. It's just, you know, when we're talking about the long-term effects, we need to have a lot more conversations about the Department of Defense budget, which is carries the largest share of the United States budget, and what the trade-offs are, really, in terms of human capacity, human spirit, who we hold in. I'm increasingly hearing this phrase, and I heard it about 10 years ago, and it struck me then, and it continues to be really important, but who's in our circle of compassion? Who gets to be inside of that circle? And what happens to those who are left out?
Yeah, I hear that. But if we gave Zelensky $100 billion, he'd spend $99 billion of it on their war needs and not on their and that doesn't include, you know, mental health for returning veterans. And, you know, in his position, I'm not sure that I would do it differently. I mean, if step one is survival, if that's what you're looking at, if you're looking at this as a fight for survival, step one is survival, and then step two is everything else. But without step one, you don't get anywhere. And I understand that's not terribly sustainable because that's what we do all the time, you know. And there's always going to be bad people out there. And if it's not Putin and if it's not Xi or whoever, it's going to be somebody. Part of that is, as the United States, we have assumed a disproportionate responsibility for, you know, defending other countries and you know, supporting them.
Since the founding of the United States.
Well, maybe a little past the founding.
You're, no, you're right, because we didn't go back to France right after.
Right.
And then, yeah.
I'd probably say, you know, starting with World War I at least,
sure.
Right?
Yes.
And maybe earlier. But
panel at WAMC.org to join the conversation. Let's see if anybody has written about this one. I think we already kind of tackled this. Okay, panel at WAMC.org to join the conversation if you would like to. Let us begin a conversation about Kristi Noem. Kristi Noem was the governor of South Dakota on Sunday. She has a book coming out. She tells a lot of stories about herself in the book. You learn a lot about her.
Rising star in the Republican Party.
Yeah, this is all so that she can be the vice president.
A front runner in discussions to be Donald Trump's running mate in the 2024 presidential election. Amid waves of backlash from both sides of the aisle, Governor Kristi Noem on Sunday defended her decision to shoot and kill her 14-month-old puppy named Cricket. I can understand why some people are upset about a 20-year-old story of Cricket, one of the working dogs at our ranch, in my upcoming book, No Going Back, she wrote on Truth Social. The fact is, South Dakota law states that dogs who attack and kill livestock can get put down. Given that Cricket had shown aggressive behavior toward people by biting them, I decided what I did, she added. Noem, until recently viewed as a top contender to share the Republican ticket with former President Donald Trump, laid out the decision to kill the pup in her forthcoming memoir. It's a startling anecdote first picked up by The Guardian. This text is from Politico. The book is set to be released May 7th. In the book, she says she tried to focus the wire hair pointer's aggressive personality into hunting, but things didn't go as planned. Cricket went out of her mind with excitement, chasing all those birds and having the time of her life. The 14-month-old puppy was then put down by gunshot by Noem herself. Libby.
I'm at a loss for words for the inhumanity of what this woman did. All right? You know, there are rescues, there are shelters, there's a humane society, there's all kinds of options for this woman to have relinquished her dog to a behaviorist. To, you know, if you're having trouble with your dog not acting the way you want them, bring in a behaviorist. You know, you want your dog to do a certain thing, bring in a behaviorist, somebody who can help you train the dog the way you want them. If you don't want the dog, you don't put a bullet in its brain. You turn it over to an animal shelter or a reputable rescue. I mean, this is just, you know, I'm fond of saying puppies and kittens are the last bastion of nonpartisanship. And so this story can very well hurt her chances to be chosen as vice president, not because Trump loves animals, because he thinks it's low class to have a pet. That's what he said about Mike Pence, because Pence had pets. But the pushback within the Trump camp, the people who support him, they also like animals. I mean, you know, there's no Republican or Democrat here. If you like animals, you like animals. If you have pets, you have pets. It doesn't matter what party you're in. I mean, you know, it's not a Democrat thing. It's not a Republican thing.
Yeah, there's not a demographic you appeal to by shooting a dog.
Right.
It's interesting that she put it on Truth Social.
Why did she put it in her book?
That's the question.
She put it in her book
to look tough.
To look tough. To look macho. Look, I did this. I didn't like the way this was behaving.
And I know how to use a gun.
Huh? And there is that, but we all know she knows how to use a gun. So, you know, it's just a disgusting display of macho I know how to use a gun, I can kill whatever I want way of life. And it's just astounding to me that this woman, you know, and then the kid came home. Where's Cricket? And Cricket was gone. And what did Mommy, how did Mommy explain that? Oh, I had to put a bullet in his brain because, you know, he was going after birds or she was going after birds. It's like, come on, you know. Ultimately,
well, I think the,
clearly,
dog, the dog actually bit a person.
Well,
think,
okay.
But, yeah.
If it's a dangerous dog, you turn it over to a vet.
Hey, I'm not
you. You turn it over to a shelter.
I'm as nonplussed as
right,
anybody else.
Right. Yeah. You turn it over to a shelter. You turn it over to a vet. You go to a behaviorist. You try to do what needs to be done for the dog.
Right.
You know, but no. She didn't have the time to do that. She
just
decided
yeah,
to kill it.
Wouldn't give up on a 14-month-old dog.
Well, that's
there's
the,
so much.
It's a puppy
left to do.
Right. There's a. It's a puppy.
To try.
You know, and they are hard-headed animals. You know, it's like, you know, you get a lab and it's a puppy for its entire life. So you get a golden, you know, it's Velcro for its entire life, but it's still, you know, very puppy-like. And
well, and like even looking at the most cynical alternative, this was a purebred dog. She could have sold it.
She could have sold it. She could have
returned it for a lot of money.
She could have returned it to the breeder.
Yeah.
Okay. There are plenty of options for her to do and not to have to do what she did. But this is about, I mean, here's a woman and a class of political people who rail against women wanting to control their bodies, right? And that we feel abortion is part of healthcare. Having access to the full range of reproductive health care is essential. She does not, right? She does not yet, oh, it's okay to take this life because, well, after all, it's just a dog.
Yeah, I just on the political calculus and including it in a book that's meant to introduce you to, the electorate. I don't get it. You know, I, you know, maybe there's some subtle thinking there that I'm just not seeing, but I don't, I mean, normally you would think in a book like this, you're really trying to appeal not so much to the base, right? You're trying to broaden the appeal. So I think it's as gruesome as everybody else thinks it. And, I just don't get it. I also don't get, I will say from a political standpoint, why you would pick anybody for vice president who has not been in the Senate.
Do you think he cares?
I think he knows.
Well, there is that too. But he doesn't care.
Do you think he knows?
I mean,
who's in the Senate?
I think he wants to get elected.
Yeah,
yes,
but the
absolutely.
Thing is having somebody who's from the Senate isn't going to give him any kind of increased ability to get elected. The fact of the matter is that, you know, she is an executive. This is an executive type position. But I don't think he cares about that. I think he thinks the Senate is just an impediment to his power.
Oh, I see. I'll give him more credit for thinking than that. I think that he learned the first time that just being president isn't enough, and you have to, and there's other levers that you have to pull. Which I think, by the way, he's learned a bunch of them, as witnessed by how well he handled the primaries as opposed to say the last time, right? I mean, say what you want. He certainly he got his team together, his act together for the primaries, and I suspect that he's thinking that, you know, there's more. It helps to be able to have some input at the Senate. I think that's what he thought Pence would be.
Right.
And then to an extent,
look how that worked
he
out.
Might, well, to I don't know. I don't know. You know, he did get some legislation done. I don't know if this is more favorable to Tim Scott now. I don't know.
So interestingly, Kristi Noem wrote a book in 2022 called Not My First Rodeo, Lessons from the Heartland, which seems like a rip-roaring read. but a quote from that says, this is her last book.
Hold your quote.
Hold the quote.
Hold
We're
the quote.
We're taking a break.
We are.
We'll bring you back.
We will be right back. Rich is going to head out. Thank you, Rich, for being here. We'll return after this. Welcome to the final segment of this morning's roundtable. As I mentioned quickly before the break, Rich Honan had to depart at 10:30. He is out of here for now. Political consultant and lobbyist Libby Post is here, and Albany Law School professor of law and director of the Justice Center, Sarah Rogerson, is here. We have a letter from Maya who said, please remember to explain who and what you were talking about mid-conversation. I started listening mid-conversation about someone who shot their dog and wrote about it, but I still don't know who it was.
Christy
Thank you.
Noem.
Christy Noem.
The governor of North Dakota.
South Dakota, I think.
No, I think she's
South Dakota.
South Dakota. Oh, the governor of South Dakota. I stand corrected.
33rd governor of South Dakota, serving since 2019, and a Trump VP contender, high on the list of Trump VP contenders. So we apologize, Maya. It is Christy Noem, governor of South Dakota.
And home of the Badlands and Mount Rushmore.
Mount Rushmore.
Right.
And That's Deadwood.
but she wrote a book in 2022 called Not My First Rodeo, Lessons from the Heartland, that contains a quote in contrast to her book that's about to be released this year, 2024. And her quote is, respecting animals means making the effort to understand them, their habits, needs, and even their fears. Respecting people often means taking those things into account, too. None of us are perfect, but all of us deserve respect.
Oh, well, I guess so she forgot what she wrote, huh?
But she had also, the story of Cricket was longer ago than that book. So she wrote that sentence and published it in 2022 and then told the story otherwise in 2024. It just doesn't make a lot of, I mean.
Cricket is a dog.
Cricket is a dog.
For those
Cricket
of you is just
the,
tuning in.
Cricket the, is the dog. Yes, the German wired hair pointer.
Right. A hunting dog.
A hunting dog. And hunting dogs need a lot of activity.
Mm-hmm. Tons.
And they're energy focused. Steven writes in and says, Steven says, it ain't the dog, it's the owner.
Right.
Their grammar.
It always is.
Yes.
It always is the owner. It's like when people demonize pit bulls.
That's exactly what Steve says.
Right.
Here.
It's not the dog, it's the owner.
He says, I'm on my second pit rescue from Saugerties Animal Shelter. The first was an 8-year-old. Owner surrendered Beauty, who drank up all the love and one-on-one attention in a rehab with me. The second, Current, was a stray put out to survive on her own after just giving birth to pups. They've both proven to be amazing dogs and made me a much more compassionate human.
Thank you for adopting from the Saugerties Animal Shelter.
Is that one of yours, Libby?
Yes, it's one of my members, and they're actually going to be building a new shelter soon.
So are they in a capital campaign? Or are they set?
They're in a capital campaign. They could use more. The Saugerties Animal Welfare Fund is doing the capital campaign, and I've been working with them quite a bit. They got $500,000 from the Companion Animal Capital Fund.
Panel at WAMC.org to join the conversation. In our last 10 or so minutes, let's talk about the White House Correspondents' Dinner, which is something I feel like...
I
don't know
that
I do always miss it, and I also I don't know if we should be doing it anymore. But that is an opinion. Let us discuss this from the AP. The war in Gaza spurred large protests outside a glitzy roast with President Joe Biden. Journalists, politicians, and celebrities Saturday, but went all but unmentioned by participants inside, with Biden instead using the annual White House Correspondents' Dinner to make both jokes and grim warnings about Republican rival Donald Trump's fight to reclaim the U.S. presidency. An evening normally devoted to presidents, journalists, and comedians taking outrageous pokes at political scandals and each other often seem this year to illustrate the difficulty of putting aside the coming presidential election and the troubles in the Middle East and elsewhere. Biden opened his roast with a direct but joking focus on Trump, calling him Sleepy Don in reference to a nickname Trump had given the president previously. Despite being similar in age, Biden said the two presidential hopefuls have little else in common. My vice president actually endorses me, Biden said. Former Trump vice president Mike Pence has refused to endorse Trump's re-election bid. But the president quickly segued into a grim speech about what he believes is at stake this election, saying that another Trump administration would be even more harmful to America than his first term. Trump did not attend Saturday's dinner and never attended the annual banquet as president. In 2011, he sat in the audience and glowered through a roasting by then-President Barack Obama of Trump's reality television celebrity status. Memorable. We all
yes.
talk about
Drop
that often.
Drop the mic.
Obama's sarcasm was then so scalding that many political watchers linked it to Trump's subsequent decision to run for president in 2016. The comedian who hosted or gave their, you know, the main address was Colin Jost of Saturday Night Live. And I read about it. I did not see it, but let's discuss. Sarah or Libby, who wants to go?
Go ahead.
Well, it's just it's a very American celebrity consumable event that's actually about really important things, right? And I think I don't know that much about the history, but I think it's intended to sort of blow off steam because you've got journalists who cover Washington, D.C. politics who have to ask hard questions and do it. But anytime you have to get dressed up for like a black tie thing and it's work related, you know that something else is happening. And it's not generally, the something else generally isn't to like improve morale. It's performative. People are literally performing. You know, Colin Jost is a professional actor married to another professional actor who is a lot more famous than he is, Scarlett Johansson.
Yeah, that's right.
And there was a joke about that because he's used to being the second gentleman. But like, what do these jokes do other than help with, you know, move along the coarsening of our dialogue with each other? You know, it's sort of like... It's not the same as The Daily Show, I guess. It's
no, it's not. But it's, look, I used to go to the LCA show here.
Okay.
Right. I for years and years and years, I would go. I actually did the books that came out. And this was like in the 80s and 90s. And it's a way the LCA show here is a lampoon of the government and legislature. And I mean, I remember when Alan was described as a fire hydrant with a tie, you know.
Alan Chartok?
Yeah, in one of the shows. I mean, this was 25 years ago. It's a way of blowing off steam. It's, you know, just because people are dressed up doesn't mean they can't have a good time. I mean, it's the Washington correspondence. This is an evening, just like in the LCA, it's an evening for politics and comedy to come together, for the legislature and the politicians and the journalists to break bread together, to make fun of one another, and then go back to their usual, you know, adversarial relationships after it's all over. But to some degree, it's a way of humanizing the relationship between the two entities that are constantly at war, in a sense, not at war like real war, but it just, you know...
At odds.
You know, journalists have a job to do. Politicians have a job to do. Sometimes it works together. Sometimes, most times it doesn't. And so I just think that, you know, it's just one of those things. I don't think it's nefarious in any way. I think it's just what they do on a yearly basis. I remember watching Trump glowering during that speech. Because he's, you know, he's so thin-skinned, he can't take any good-natured anything or ribbing of any kind.
Well, I don't think it's nefarious. I just think it's frivolous.
Well, yeah, but you know what? Sometimes we need to be frivolous. I mean, I'm sorry, but...
Sure, but do you make it into a whole circus and, invite celebrities?
Yeah,
and,
but that's what this is. It's a dinner. It's a dinner. And there's nothing wrong with people having this dinner. You know, I mean, I don't see the problem here. You know, is it the master class in a sense? Is it the upper echelons of Washington elite? Yes, it is. You know, but that's what the politicians and the journalists, that's what where they occupy. That's the space that they occupy. You know, I don't know how elite it is here in Albany, but it's the same space that they occupy, and they make fun of one another and they have an evening to sort of, you know, relax. The thing that happened here was that chance of Shame on You and Free Palestine and all the rest of that they were greeted with. And I have to tell you, I went to the Columbia County Blue Wave breakfast yesterday and we were greeted with the same thing. And that's freedom of speech. They have their right to be out there and doing what they want to do. But I don't think it's nefarious. I don't think it's mean spirit. I think it is what it is.
Just the power dynamics. Do you think that I'm not a journalist. I'm just a lawyer. We don't get invited to these things, so we have to have our own.
Don't you go to the Bar Association?
Yeah, but they're elected officials,
sure.
Right? They're not regular lawyers. But I'm wondering if the journalists really get as much out of that whole production as the people who are in power and having the side conversations do or not, or if they go because they feel obligated, or even the tiers of people within journalism. So like, if my boss is going and I'm supposed to be there and sit at the table, like, does it really help them do their job better that they
It's about relationship building.
Yeah.
Journalism is all about having relationships with people.
I'm just saying there are other ways to do that. I'm
sure.
Wondering whether
this is one night a year. Okay? It's one night a year. This doesn't happen every week. It doesn't happen every month. It's annual. So they have some fun annually, one night a year. Then they continue to build their relationships or not build their relationships as it goes during the course of the year. It, you know, I can't fault somebody for wanting to have a little bit of fun in this climate that we live in. I can't. And that's what, for most of these people, that's what it is. You know, Norm O'Donnell gets really dressed up to the nines, right? She's the president of the Washington Correspondents Association, you know, and they raise money for charities, which usually happens from these dinners. It's not like the money goes into anybody's pocket, per se. And they have some fun, and they make fun of one another, and they talk about things, and relationships continue to be built. And that's what the core of any journalist's work is, having relationships with people, to be able to call and find out and get the information that they need. I mean, I'm one of those people they call.
I didn't know you were so passionate about the correspondence dinner.
Well, what I'm passionate about is letting journalists do their job.
Yeah.
Right? And this is part of it. And also recognizing that journalists are people just like everybody else. They need to laugh. So are politicians. Some of them I like, some of them I don't. But they're people just like everybody else. And it's a good thing for them to laugh every so often.
Jonathan writes in and says about our previous topic, South Dakota tourism, you can't forget the Crazy Horse Monument. And we have an American pit bull, a great dog from Otsego County Shelter.
Oh,
great.
Thank you.
We also heard from Carrie, who says, I watched almost the entire White House Correspondents' Dinner on C-SPAN the other night, and I just wanted to point out that a good hour in the beginning was devoted to awarding many of the different scholarships. So unless there's another venue that can be created to award these well-deserved scholarships, I don't think should be canceled. Thank you.
And
I'm a devoted listener.
And let me just say
that I'm cleaning my horse stalls every morning. Go.
They're mostly journal. I would assume they're mostly journalism scholarships, right? And we need that. We need more folks to come into journalism and to make it their profession. And, you know, we need there to be an ability for them to go from J school into a job. And so I'm proud to say that, you know, the budget included $30 million for the Local Journalism Sustainability Act to provide tax credits to the first half, the first $50,000 of a journalist's salary, so publishers can repopulate their newsrooms. And, you know, if we let journalism die in this country, we are in trouble. It's just that simple, because then Trump and the rest of them will take over and we will be living in a fascist state.
It's just that, like, unlike Emmys, Grammys, Oscars, Tonys, which I enjoy them all, even though it's like I have a similar feeling about it. Like, where's the celebration for journalism students who are doing well, or academics who are, you know, curing cancer and different things like that? Unlike that group of folks, right, the funding that puts on parties for relationship building, sometimes I just worry about whether that could be redirected to some more sustainable ways to promote journalism in the country.
Lucinda writes in and says, I agree with Libby. Society needs to blow off steam, and society needs comedy. And with the sentiment of society needs comedy, we're going to end the show today. We get to end on that point.
Like that.
I couldn't pick. I know it's not the thesis of the show, but it is a nice way to go off until the next time we have to get down into it. The panel this morning, Rich Honan, Libby Post, and Sarah Rogerson, thank you for being here, Libby and Sarah, for still being here. The Congressional Corner is next. I'm Sarah LaDuke in for Joe Donahue, and you are listening to The Roundtable.